Radio EcoShock.
Since gaining her PhD in environmental engineering and moving to Stanford University, Sharon Gurji has specialized in the impacts of climate change and food production around the world. Her latest co-authored paper was published in Environmental Research Letters in June 2013. Its title tells us something important for everyone who eats: global crop exposure to critical high temperatures in the reproductive period, historical trends, and future projections. Sharon, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
I was introduced to this subject by an unlikely source. A hippie YouTuber from Texas, if you can believe that, complained his garden flowered but set no fruit because nighttime temperatures stayed too high just at that critical time. Is that related to the paper you published?
So I just published a paper looking at trends in exposure to extreme heat during that critical reproductive period for crops, and then looking into the future to how we expect this to change in the coming decades. So you're absolutely right that the reproductive stage of crops when they flower is that very risky time where if the flower doesn't get fertilized and set into a grain or a fruit, then you're not going to have anything to eat at the end of the season.
So it's not just that it's getting hotter, but it's when it gets hotter that counts for agriculture. Is that right?
Well, again, the reproductive stage is an especially risky time because, you know, if the flower doesn't set, you'll have no yield. But it's also true that warming temperatures are also impacting crop yields through other pathways. So, for example, warming temperatures make crops develop faster. And so if they have less days in the season, they gain less biomass and also have less yield at the end of the season. But that's sort of more of a gradual change and more of a, you know, less noticeable change than something like the grain never sets and again, you have nothing to eat.
Right, I get it. So, well, Lester Brown from the Earth Policy Institute has stressed some major crops, including rice, are already near their temperature limits. What have you heard about that?
Well, it's true that a lot of our major globally traded crops around the world, wheat, corn, rice, and soybean, are already grown near their temperature optimums, and in many cases and in many regions, above their temperature optimums. But I think it's good to make a distinction between temperature limit and optimum, which is to say that if it gets warmer by 1 degree, yields are going to start to decline, but they're not going to fall off the cliff. We're still going to have something to eat. And there are adaptation measures that people are already thinking about proactively to help mitigate some of these declines. But it's definitely something that we need to be thinking about.
And you've published research on efforts to increase wheat yields. It sounds to me like the focus has been on the high production areas with less work so far on the most climate-threatened zones. Is that an accurate perception? And also, a second question, are GMOs the only solution?
Well, those are very difficult questions. I mean, I think, you know, more and more people are starting to think about climate change and starting to factor that into their future planning. So you do have very active plant breeding efforts around the world to try to prepare our crops for future climate conditions. A lot of this is classical plant breeding. It's not necessarily GMO. A lot of this is done by, there's an international network of centers called the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research. And they do a lot of classical plant breeding. They were behind the Green Revolution in Asia, mostly in Asia and Latin America, that helped increase yields. So they're starting to think ahead about future climate conditions. The paper I published on wheat, what we found was that to date, in the last 30 years, there hasn't been a ton of progress in helping to improve yield potential for wheat in the hottest areas. It's mostly been in the areas like in Northern Africa and South America, where there's already relatively optimal conditions. Places like South Asia, where they're already growing wheat at really hot temperatures already, there needs to be more of a sustained push to try to help develop the future germplasm that's more tolerant to future climate conditions.
Sharon Gurji, let's get into the details of your recent paper. Maybe we should start with the historic trends. What are the trends in crops related to temperature?
So again, my most recent paper is on looking at these trends in exposure to extreme heat during the reproductive period. So I just want to stress again that this is not looking at all the combined global change and environmental change factors that are impacting yields and you know, how yields are going to change into the future. It's just looking at that reproductive stage. We did look at these four major crops that are referred to earlier: wheat, maize, rice, and soybean, and we looked at all of their major harvested areas around the world. And we found for the last 30 years that there has been a sustained increase in exposure to extreme heat during the reproductive period especially for wheat and especially in Central and South Asia, which is increasing the risk of production in these areas. For corn, we also found some substantial exposure, but it was in more kind of isolated, scattered regions around the world. For rice and for soybean, we haven't seen a lot of exposure to date, but looking forward into the future using climate model projections, we start to see large nonlinear increases in exposure to reproductive extreme heat for rice and also for corn in tropical areas, because again, a lot of these areas are already growing these major cereal crops near or higher than their optimal temperatures, and there's going to be an increased risk of crossing these critical thresholds in the reproductive stage.
Well, some of this research must use climate models, and they have been criticized by climate skeptics. How good are the models?
Well, this is a very good question. So I think the million-dollar question people want to know is, what is going to be the impact of global climate change on yields 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now? So you have multiple layers of uncertainty in trying to answer a question like this. The first is the climate models themselves. Now, the climate models are relatively robust at large spatial scales, and especially when it comes to temperature. They're less robust at looking at what's going to be the rainfall change in, say, the state of California, 30 years from now. That's a little bit a harder question that climate models don't have quite a good handle on right now. Then you get into the layer of crop models, and crop models, again, they've been developed for different purposes over the years. A lot of times they were developed for the farm level to aid in management decisions, and they're calibrated to the range of current climate conditions, not necessarily, what's going to happen in the future and what's going to happen over large spatial scales. So there's a lot of work to be done in improving the crop models. And then finally, the third layer of uncertainty comes down to how are farmers going to respond to some of the changes we're anticipating in the future. And farmers are adapting all the time to changes in market conditions and climate conditions. So they're going to be able to mitigate some of the projected damages that we may be seeing coming out of the model. So there's multiple layers of uncertainty. And a lot of the times it comes down to, what question are you asking? And is it a tractable question that it's possible to answer given the current state of our modeling capabilities?
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with environmental scientist from Stanford, Sharon Gorgi. We're talking about your food supply. Sharon, tell us about your trip to Nicaragua in September 2013.
Well, I had a great year, and I actually just finished up a year as a Fulbright scholar in a new program called the Fulbright Nexus Program, which is focused on doing applied interdisciplinary research to address sustainable development challenges in the Western Hemisphere. So as part of this program, I had the opportunity to spend 3 months in Colombia this year at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, which is one of these CGIAR centers I referred to previously. And while I was there, I got involved in a project looking at the impacts of climate change on maize and bean production in Central America. And then as part of that project, my contribution was looking at some historical government statistics on yield in Nicaragua and correlating it with weather data in the last 30 or 40 years to see up until now how much has historic climate trends in the region impacted maize and bean yields and what are farmers doing to adapt. So I did have the opportunity to visit Nicaragua. I was there in January, and I went just a few weeks ago, actually in September, and I had the opportunity to visit farms in the northern Pacific Dry Corridor in the province of Madrid. Also, I went to a farm in Granada, which is 2 hours south of Managua. I also had the opportunity in January to go to the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua and talk with people working on sustainable agriculture in that region. I also had a number of meetings with government agencies who are providing the data and also obviously know their country better than anyone and who are able to help explain some of the trends that we're seeing in the data and, potential options that farmers may have in the future to cope with these changes.
And in your slide presentation, I was astounded to learn the forest cover in Nicaragua has been slashed to just one-third of what it was in 1980. So it's not just climate change in these factors of agriculture, but that must impact local weather and ecosystems too. How does deforestation feed back into climate and crop yields?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think it's something that's important for people to keep in mind. So global climate change is happening, and as a big, large world, we need to think about it. But there's a lot of trends happening on smaller spatial scales around the world as well. And in the tropics, deforestation is a big one. So like you said, Nicaragua has lost a third of its forest cover, and this has had large feedback effects actually on regional climate, apart from changes in global greenhouse gases. So, for example, you see a rate of daytime warming in Nicaragua, which is about 3 times higher than the global average in the tropics since the 1970s. And this is a clear consequence of deforestation in the region. Deforestation is also likely changing some of the rainfall patterns in the region, you know, leading to a longer drought period in between the two main rainy seasons, maybe a later start to the rainy season. It's a little harder with the rainfall to tease apart the, let's say, the impacts of deforestation versus some of the global forcings, but there's likely to be some kind of impact. And the other thing about deforestation is that it tends to reduce soil infiltration and increase surface runoff. So you end up with less soil moisture and larger problems with soil erosion, which is already one of the biggest problems facing farmers in Central America.
That's really interesting stuff. And I wonder how farmers are expected to adapt to temperature changes during these key periods for crops that you've studied.
Well, you know, again, it depends on what farmer you're talking about. So there are definitely large differences in adaptive capacity for large-scale commercial farms in the industrialized world, as opposed to, you know, small rain-fed farmers in tropical areas. So it depends on what's feasible for different farmers in different situations. In the developing world, you know, there are a lot of gains to be made from things that have nothing to do with climate change. So increasing access to fertilizers or more widespread use of improved seed, better soil management. And these things will help improve yields regardless of, you know, what farmers are doing to deal with additional climate stresses.
Sharon, is it your sense that new developments in things like seeds or changes in crops will be able to overcome the problems expected during a relatively rapid shift of climate, or is famine more likely to reappear?
Well, this is, again, a very, very difficult question. And when you're talking about things like famine and food security, you get into the realm of governance and economics and markets. You know, a lot of famines around the world have been related to problems in governance rather than, you know, actual amount of yield or amount of food that was produced in a given area. But in terms of trying to plan ahead for future climate conditions, there is a large concerted global effort to try to breed new germplasm that will be more resilient to future climate conditions. The issue is, again, it comes down to governance. So, like, how do you get this improved germplasm to the people who need it most and make sure that it works for them in their context? In Nicaragua, for example, only about 15% of farmers use improved seed to be worth the cost for them, and they tend to prefer to eat the local traditional varieties. So, you know, you can't tell people, oh, well, you have to eat this new thing, which you think tastes like crap. Well, you have to make sure that you have some kind of seed that's acceptable in local market conditions, but also has built in this additional buffering capacity for future climate conditions.
Well, Sharon Gurji, I'm trying to picture a farmer in the developing world, perhaps in Pakistan or China. This family's always grown a certain crop in a certain way based on the seasons and seasonal rain. I'm having a hard time picturing any program that could help that farmer in time if critical temperatures are changed. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think one thing you have to keep in mind is that farmers are already experts in dealing with climate variability. The weather changes from year to year, and farmers have to be able to deal with this variability in order to survive and to thrive. When you're talking about global climate change, you're talking about long-term shifts in the average climate. So it's not the kind of thing that, you know, okay, tomorrow temperatures are going to change. Oh, my God, people have to do something. So it's more a matter of how do you help support farmers in their current efforts to deal with current climate variability and help build in their long-term capacity to deal with change.
Are there a lot of scientists studying the limits of our food crops?
Absolutely. I mean, not only do you have all the people like myself who are focusing on climate change and agriculture, the study of agriculture in itself is one of the longest standing fields of science in human endeavors. People from thousands of years have been trying to improve our crops, get them to grow better under different conditions, you know, come up with new varieties that have characteristics that we want. You know, you already have large research efforts, for example, in the United States, land grant colleges that have agricultural extension services that work directly with farmers. So there's a lot of people all around the world. You know, people obviously are very concerned about their food supplies and their food security. And there's a lot of effort going into making sure that we're going to be able to feed populations around the world in the coming decades.
Well, here's a question I know my listeners are asking themselves, and I'd like to get your viewpoint. Is there a point at which we reach peak food?
Well, I personally don't like that term because I think it's a little bit scary. I think it's a little bit of scaremongering. So, you know, when you talk about peak oil, that's okay. Oil production can decline because we have other options. We have renewables. They may be expensive, but, you know, there's other options. In the case of food, there's no other options. We have to eat. Like, that's all that you can really say. And in terms of dealing with a changing climate and perhaps a degrading environment, there are substantial challenges that remain in terms of us being able to ensure our food supply in the coming centuries. But I think there's a lot of people working on it. I don't think failure is an option, and I think we're going to be able to deal with change. We've been dealing with change as human beings for thousands of years. You know, we don't have to deal with things that were major problems thousands of years ago, like maybe, you know, a wild animal coming into your house in the middle of the night, at least in developed countries. And so, you know, we have new challenges facing us.
Do you have suggestions where listeners can go to dig deeper into this subject?
Well, you know, I think there's been an explosion of information and interest in this field. So, you know, basically doing a web search, you might come up with a lot of great sources. There's a lot of great blogs now that are devoted to food security. One of them is maintained by my boss, David Lobel at Stanford, with some of his collaborators, and it's just called g-seed.com. I think that's a really good source.
Sharon, what are you working on now?
Well, right now I'm finishing up my study for Nicaragua on the impacts of historical climate change on maize and bean production. So what I've found so far is that in the case of Nicaragua, maize has been much less impacted by climate change than red bean. And red bean is very sensitive to climate change, increases in intensity of rainfall, also seasonal drought in certain areas of the country. And there's definitely been a downward pressure on yields for red beans in the country. And it's interesting because I was just there and I was talking with people, and the country has actually just banned the export of red beans because of concerns about food security. And they're now giving incentives to producers to cultivate black beans, which by chance happen to be more hardy. They're less sensitive to high temperatures and drought. They're trying to get farmers to switch over. Of course, Nicaraguans prefer to eat red beans, not black beans. So they're mostly exporting the black beans abroad. But, you know, it's an evidence of a climate adaptation in action. So my next paper is going to be looking at trying to quantify to what extent farmers are adapting to these changes and what sorts of measures are they using, and what sort of extra support could they use in order to adapt to these additional stresses on their livelihoods.
Our guest has been environmental engineer and crop researcher Sharon Gurgi from Stanford University in California. She's co-author of the paper Global Crop Exposure to Critical High Temperatures in the Reproductive Period, Historical Trends, and Future Projections. Find more links in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Sharon, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you, Alex. It was a great pleasure. I really enjoyed it, and I'm happy for the opportunity to connect with the listeners on your program.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.